I'll call the Committee on Ways and Means to order. I don't believe we quite have a quorum yet, so we're going to start, and we'll come back to the minutes later. Our agenda today is presentation from Minnesota Management Budget. Lead off, Commissioner Franz.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having us here this morning to talk about the budget forecast and the budget and economic forecast. My name is Myron Franz, Commissioner of Minnesota Management Budget. Dr. Laura Kalumbakidis, sitting to my left, will talk about the economic aspects, and Margaret Kelly, Budget Director, sitting behind me, will come up and talk about the budget stuff. I just wanted to kind of kick it off, give you some overview, and get the numbers set, and then get into the real meat of this presentation, because I think it's really important that we get to that right away. So, of course, this thing isn't working like I want it to. Anyway, so if someone could come up, hit the button.
Any key.
That's what they say, hit any key, but that's not true. I've hit several already. So here's how I want to set the stage and let you all ask questions and get into the meat of this thing. So obviously we're talking about the eighth forecast in a row with a positive balance. And in this case, what we're seeing is the balance for 18 and 19 has gone up $250 million from $1.4 billion that we forecast in November to $1.65 billion. Clearly, mainly what we're talking about is the difference between today or the February forecast and what we're talking about in November. So if you look to the planning estimate, remember the planning estimate is we don't enact a budget for the planning estimate time period, but we do provide this for planning purposes to look at out in the future. We see that planning estimate has gone up $684 million. We were forecasting $1.44 billion in November, and now we're estimating a $2.124 billion planning estimate for 2021. Now, some things that have not changed, and that is the fact that we still have about $2 billion in cash and budget reserves. Most of you know that that's $350 million of a cash account and about a little over $1.6 billion in the actual reserve account. The target reserve account is about $2 billion just for the target reserve account itself. So we're $300 million below what the target is for the budget reserve account. We also, though, see a number of significant risks going forward. So I think the real key today is for Dr. Kalumbakidis to explain the economic situation and the forecast risk that we see. But I think one of the things that I wanted to talk about to sort of set the stage for this conversation was the fact that we've sort of been here before. We in the 1990s had a great economic recovery. Most of you remember it was a long recovery and quite robust, frankly, more robust than the recovery we've seen since the Great Recession. But at the end of the 1990s, we had some significant balances at that time, that some of which were given back to the taxpayers and some of which were invested. But also, that's when we changed the income tax rates in 1999 and 2000. And then, of course, the dot-com bubble burst in 2000, and we had a recession. And then that whole decade of the 2000 to 2011, we experienced 9 out of 11 deficit years. So I think we want to make sure that we point out the risk inherent in going forward, the risk that any forecast has. And I think one of the key risks is we haven't collected a single dollar from this forecast period yet because it hasn't even started. So with that in mind, I want to turn it over to Dr. Kalumbakidis to provide the economic overview. And unless there are any questions before we jump into that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Kalumbakidis.
Any questions? Before we start, Dr. Kalumbakidis, I'm going to ask for a motion to accept the minutes from the last meeting, since we now have a quorum. Representative Baker moves. Any discussion? Not. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Laura Kalumbakidis, state economist and professor of applied economics at the University of Minnesota. As you heard from Commissioner Franz, I will start by talking about the U.S. economic outlook that informed our revenue forecast. I'll move to say a few things about Minnesota's economy, and then I will give you the update on the revenue forecast. So the first slide shows annual real GDP growth both the history and the forecast by Minnesota's macroeconomic consulting firm IHS. So the dark bars show the history and IHS's February 2017 forecast, which is the one that informed our most recent revenue forecast. And the light bars show IHS's November forecast. The chart shows that the outlook for U.S. economic growth improved from November to February. The economic data, if you've been watching the business news, the economic data coming in since December has been mostly positive, showing improvements in personal income, business spending on equipment and structures, employment, and consumer spending. In addition to that, those positive economic factors, IHS has incorporated into their baseline outlook federal fiscal stimulus in the form of lower individual and corporate tax rates and increased infrastructure spending. And those two pieces of fiscal stimulus are expected to boost economic growth starting in 2018 and continuing through the forecast period. So you can see that boost to growth in the height of the bar for 2018. IHS slightly increased their outlook for the current year from 2.2% in November to 2.3% now. And then again, higher forecasts for real consumer spending, buoyed by that expected fiscal stimulus, and a higher forecast for business capital purchases, both of those things offset increased drag from net exports to raise the 2018 growth forecast from 2.2% in November to 2.7% in February. One of the reasons for that, I said that was due to that change in 18 was due to increased forecast for consumer spending and for business investment. So I want to drill down and talk about the consumer spending forecast here. And that's what we show here. The height of the bars shows annual growth in real consumer spending, both the history and the forecast.
I can interrupt.
Chairman, we got several documents here, and if we want to follow along with a hard copy, which one should we be looking at?
You should be looking at the slide set, the PowerPoint slide set that looks like this.
I don't believe we... What we have is the complete forecast, but I don't believe we have the slide presentation.
Okay. The
Page 9.
Yeah.
Okay.
I assume that was where it was.
Yeah. We may be able to refer to the pages in the book for some of these. It doesn't. The consumer spending chart is on page 9 of the U.S. Economic Outlook section of the book. So if you look at page 9 of the book, that slide is there. So the real consumer spending forecast changed for 2018 changed from 2.5% in November to 3.2% in February. And that's due to two things. That increased growth expectation is due to two things. It's due to consumer spending, positive news about consumer spending, and that consumer spending is expected to be supported by economic factors. So it's expected to be supported by improvements in employment, earnings, and household wealth. And household wealth has grown both because home prices have grown and because the stock market has improved, and so household portfolios have improved. So those things are supposed to support, are expected to support improved consumer spending. But in addition, as I said, the February outlook assumes lower U.S. personal tax rates and new infrastructure spending spread over 10 years. And that's expected to fuel real consumer spending growth starting in 2018. So you'll see that stronger consumer spending growth reflected in our sales tax forecast. So I'm going to move to the Minnesota economy. And the next slide, I'm not sure, is in the book. So it's already there. But before I move on to the Minnesota economy, I want to highlight some of the risks that you heard Commissioner Franz talk about. Considerable certainty remains in the U.S. outlook about which proposed U.S. economic policy changes will be enacted in the near term and their impact on the economy. So what IHS has said since the election is that as economic policy becomes clearer, they're assessing the probability of things passing, of proposals passing, and the impact on the U.S. economy becomes clearer, they will incorporate those changes into the forecast. So they did incorporate into their forecast that the lower individual and corporate tax rates and some additional infrastructure spending spread over 10 years. But at this time, IHS feels there's not enough clarity regarding changes to trade policy, immigration policy, healthcare policy, and business investment incentives to incorporate those into the outlook. So until those changes become more clear, their impact on key economic sectors, including financial services, manufacturing, international trade, and healthcare, all remain sources of risk to this forecast. And even aside from U.S. policy uncertainty, there are risks inherent in this forecast. The rate of real GDP growth, I'll go back a couple slides here, that rate of real GDP growth that you see forecast here from 2.2% to 2.7%, that's lower than the average that we used to see prior to the Great Recession. So the 20-year average annual real GDP growth prior to the Great Recession was 3.1%. That means that we're in a relatively low growth expansion period. And when the U.S. economy is growing at a relatively low pace, that means that it is more vulnerable to unexpected risks, so more vulnerable to shocks that could happen. In addition, the expansion that we're in now is the fourth longest expansion on U.S. record. It's all nearly tied for third. And so it's a long economic expansion, and the longer it goes, the riskier the bet that that growth will continue. The slide in front of you now is Minnesota nominal wage and salary disbursements, and I don't believe this is replicated in the book. So this is total wage and salary income for the state of Minnesota. It's as if you add up all the payrolls for all the employers of the state of Minnesota, and the height of the bars shows the annual growth in that number. So that number can grow when employment is growing, so when we have more people working, or when the people working are making more money per person, or when both of those things are happening. And in our forecast, both of those things are happening. There's relatively small changes in our wage and salary income forecast, but we do expect we do have a higher forecast for wage and salary income growth in 2018 and 19 than we had in the prior forecast. But Minnesota's economy continues on its moderate growth path. The state continues to add jobs at a steady rate, so that that steady employment growth, relatively moderate rate of employment growth, is in our forecast. And that keeps the state's unemployment rate below the U.S. rate. We have robust demand for workers, together with low unemployment, and that's created a tight labor market. That puts upward pressure on wages. Statewide, there are about as many job vacancies as there are job seekers, and recent months have seen increases in both average number of weekly hours worked by private sector employees and their average hourly earnings. So again, we do expect wages per worker to pick up because of that tight labor market, and that combined with moderate employment growth will cause total wage and salary income to grow between 4.7 and 5.2% per year over the forecast horizon. And then that increased forecast for wage and salary income growth, you'll see that in our income tax forecast.
Dr. Kung, please, we have a couple of questions. Sure. I'll go to Representative Norris first.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, to the witness. My question is, I'm looking for agriculture. Where does agriculture factor into your forecast?
So agriculture is in the Minnesota nominal wage and salary income disbursements number. If there are wages earned in agriculture, that's in there. The income that's earned by farm proprietors, so by farmers themselves, that's in our farm proprietor income forecast. And if there's income that's earned by any sector that is sort of dependent on farming or adjacent to farming, those would be in the wage and salary income forecast for that sector, or in the proprietor income forecast for that sector. If you wanted to, those things are enumerated in the charts starting on page 55.
Representative Norris,
I think that covers it. I was just a little concerned because it didn't jump out at me as a separate category.
Sure.
And I know that's an area that has a lot of negative pressure on it right now. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't sure how you factored that in.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, when we do the income tax forecast, we separately forecast farm proprietor income that will show up on income tax returns. And so you don't see that particular line, but it is embedded in our income tax forecast. And what I can say about that is that you're right, that farm income has come down from the peaks of 2013 and 14, and we've had, I think, three consecutive years of negative growth or decline in net farm income. In our forecast, we have that turning around positive, I think, in next year. But at the moment, the commodity prices for major crops like soybean and corn are still relatively low. They've come up a bit from the bottom, but they're still relatively low. The USDA forecasts that 2016 would have been the low point for net farm income, and then it would pick up after that.
Thank you.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, Doctor, I was curious, the wage survey you're looking at here, too, does that also include benefits? Do you track the health care benefits? Do you care, you know, that other sort of the other pressures with employers that kind of maybe put some pressure on keeping wages about even, it looks like, the next couple of years? How is that factored in there as well?
Dr. Kamakikis.
Chairman, members of the committee, this is just disbursements of wage and salary income, so it to the extent that benefits are not taxable under the income tax, then they're not going to be included in our income tax forecast. So that the cost of benefits to an employer would might affect, as you suggest, how much actual wages they pay out. It also might affect the proprietor profits that they take in, and we're forecasting both of those pieces, but we're not forecasting separately the value of health care benefits.
Representative Paulsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It may be in here somewhere, but do you discuss at all the fact that the bottom has dropped out of the tourism industry because of the perception we're no longer a welcoming country and everyone carries guns and uses them? That it's a rather broadly perceived view of what our country is right now.
Dr. Kamapokikas.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman, members of the committee, to the extent that those factors influence what the U.S. Economic forecast for tourism, the Minnesota's share of that would be reflected here, but I don't have any specific information about how that would have been reflected in the U.S. outlook.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifiers, first of all, as to the tourism people tell me that Minnesota is smoking right along. So the question that I had to do with the farm, kind of a call-up on Representative Nornes' question about the farm economy, and then you mentioned something about 16. And that was going to be my question, too, is how does your forecast interact with kind of the federal forecast? And you mentioned something about USDA. Could you explain that for me, please?
Sure.
How the two reports kind of come together?
Doctor.
Chairman, representative, members of the committee, we separately forecast U.S. or Minnesota farm income to specifically forecast what's going to show up on tax returns, which may or may not be consistent with what you see in the USDA forecast. But when we produce because taxable farm income is different because of the way accounting is done. It's different from other measures of net farm income. But when we produce the Minnesota forecast for farm income, we look at what the USDA is saying for national farm income. We look specifically at the crop mix in Minnesota. So we aren't just taking the USDA forecast for all farm income. We're looking at the fact that Minnesota has hogs and dairy and corn and soybeans and wheat. And so we're looking at Minnesota's farm mix and the forecasts for those crops. And we're looking at the forecast for crop prices. And we're looking at Minnesota-specific data on net farm income. So we're looking at what has come in and passed tax returns, farm income on past tax returns. So we have, we are able to, for this forecast to look at the aggregate data from tax returns in 2015 and to see what happened to farm income then. And then we use all that information to produce our forecast.
Representative Pabin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a point for reference, you know, we've got implement dealerships around the state that are closing, and it really is a scary time in the ag sector, and I just want people to be aware of that. So thank you.
Representative Davis.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, to Dr. Kambakias. I missed something here on your forecast. Does your forecast take into account the record number of tourists to this welcoming country? And they come to this country because people have guns and they feel safer. Is that included in your documents here?
Doctor.
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, as I responded to the previous question, to the extent that impacts on the U.S. tourism industry are incorporated into the U.S. forecast that we used, I can't speak to specifics there. The narrative from IHS did not describe those things specifically.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Doctor.
Please go on.
Mr. Chairman, I've had my hand up.
I'm sorry.
You keep looking to your right. I don't know if that's a political statement or not. I guess you did represent
Representative Carlson.
Representative Houseman.
Not Carlson, but Carlson.
I did have a follow-up question. I was surprised that we don't look at total compensation as a follow-up comment that was asked about earlier, because when we're dealing with state employees and we're adding somebody online, we look at what the salary level would be and also what the rest of the package would be, or the total compensation. But be that as it may, apparently we look at just the wages and hours, which leads me to my other question. You commented that we have increased hours and the average wage is increased, and what I'm asking is, if we had increased hours and people were drawing down overtime, then their average compensation would be going up, but their regular, let's say, 40-hour wage might be remaining the same. Is that correct interpretation of what could conceivably be happening out there? It's anecdotal, but I've talked to a couple people recently that are working so much overtime that they're almost to the point of exhaustion, looking forward to a day off. But that's probably going back to the worker shortage.
Dr. Klemmer-Bukitis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, members of the committee, that's an interesting point. And if average wages have, if average wages rise because of increased overtime, that would be, that could be an explanation. That could be part of this. And it would be embedded in this. The average work week, though, remains below 40 hours. And so it also could be people moving. I don't know exactly what each of the pieces of average wage increase has been, but it also could be people moving to better jobs. It could be people moving from part-time to full-time work and therefore getting a higher wage as well. But you're right that if that is going on, then that would be reflected in the higher average wage.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I assume to a degree, and I don't know how you'd measure that necessarily, but with a worker shortage, historically, I think there's been more overtime work available, and that would increase the average salary or income. So I'll just stop there, but I think some of that may be going on.
Doctor, if you want to continue.
Sure. Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the current, the slide that we have in front of you now shows our revenue forecast. It's on page 32 of the book. This is a collapsed version of the slide that's on page 32. So our revenue forecast appears in this table. What we have on the left-hand side is the forecast for the current biennium, so it's the current February forecast and the forecast change. And on the right is the new forecast for the next biennium, FY 18-19, and the dollar amount changes since November. So total general fund revenues for the current biennium are now forecast to be $75 million more than the November 16 forecast adjusted for recent law changes. And those law changes are Chapter 1, concerning federal conformity, and Chapter 2, providing health care premium relief. Higher expected individual and corporate income tax revenue more than offsets lower expected sales, state general property, and other tax revenue. The current forecast for FY18-19 revenues is $321 million more than the November forecast adjusted for law changes. The increased forecast arises primarily from higher expected growth in economic activity that I've already mentioned. Specifically, higher expected growth in wage and non-wage income. So I talked about the wage income, but also some higher expected growth in non-wage income. Interest income, for instance, has become more of a factor in this forecast as interest rates are starting to rise. And those influence the income tax. We have a higher forecast for taxable purchases. Some of that is influenced from the increased forecast for consumer spending, and that influences the sales tax. And then a higher forecast for corporate profits, and that influences the corporate tax. My last slide is just reiterating some of the risks I've talked about. So I've already talked about the U.S. policy uncertainty, significant uncertainty about U.S. fiscal, trade, immigration, regulatory policy. Some of that might be clarified in coming months, but we have to be prepared for the fact that some of that uncertainty is likely to persist for some time. Global growth will continue to affect Minnesota businesses that export manufactured goods, that export agricultural commodities that we've already talked about, and that export iron ore. And changes in trade policy will also impact those sectors. Inflation in this forecast is expected to rise gradually from what have been very low rates. But if prices accelerate more quickly than the Federal Reserve prefers, then the Fed might act in a way that could lead to a different outcome than this forecast predicts. I've talked about the long, slow growth expansion and just a caution that we haven't begun the biennium that we are forecasting here for 18-19. So I will turn it over to Budget Director Kelly.
I think Representative Anderson, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, getting back to what Representative Carlson was speaking to, I'm just wondering, usually when we're looking at the different labor market, we also look at what sector it's coming from, and, you know, in Minnesota, the government's number one employer. So if you would be able to provide us with that later on that piece, I think that would be helpful to know of what kind of wage growth was in that sector as well.
Hi, Doctor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't have wage growth by sector here, but in the book we have employment growth by sector on page 18. And let me caution that, so this is Minnesota employment change over the last four quarters by industrial sector. But I will caution that this, as always with the Bureau of Labor Statistics employment numbers, this is non-farm payrolls. So this doesn't include workers on farms. It would include workers in sectors that are dependent on the ag economy but not on farms themselves. So what you can see there, the change in employment by sector.
Representative Lubley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when Governor Dayton was elected, he and the legislature made a significant change in our income tax structure, and raising taxes on the wealthiest Minnesotans by, I think, 2%, if I remember correctly. And there has been a lot of concern, and there's been a lot of rhetoric about how that was going to harm our economy, and the rich were going to flee Minnesota, and it was going to be a disaster, and all sorts of things were going to take place. So here we are these years later, and I just wondered if you can, having now gone through several budget cycles, here we are in Governor Dayton's final budget, a year of setting his final budget, I'm wondering if you can tell us whether you can see any influence in particular from that increase in income taxes that the governor brought us here in Minnesota.
Dr. Kamakidis.
Mr. Chair, Representative, members of the committee, what I can say is that what I've described about the economy here in Minnesota, we continue our moderate growth path. We continue to add jobs. Total wage and salary income continues to grow. The income tax revenues continue to grow. All of that has happened with the economy we have and the revenue structure that we have. We didn't run the alternative experiment to see what Minnesota would look like under an alternative structure, but given the structure we have, these are the circumstances we're in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To put that another way, is it fair to say that there's no evidence that increasing the taxes on the wealthiest Minnesotans by that amount has hurt our economy?
Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, members of the committee, I don't have evidence of exits from the state due to changes in the tax rate. We don't do exit interviews with folks, and so again, I would just repeat that we don't know what the state would have looked like under an alternative structure. What we know is that given this structure, we're in the situation we are now.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, in the past, even recently, we've had a chart that shows an optimistic outlook and a pessimistic, and then I forget what we call the middle one, but kind of the
baseline.
The baseline. Where would I find that in the booklet here, or maybe it's not here? I've been thumbing through and I haven't found it. And then I have a second question, if I may.
Doctor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paulson, it's within the Council Economic Advisors Statement on page 25.
25, okay. Now look at there then, Mr. Chairman. The other one is that I know that there's at times discussions or they use a percentage dealing with the risk factors.
Mm-hmm.
And being that that's first on your handout list, you know, the risk factors, if you could tell us what the probability, the percentages are for those various risk factors.
Doctor.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative, members of the committee. IHS assigns a subjective 60% probability to the baseline outlook, which is the one that we used as the starting point for our forecast. They assign a 25% probability to a more pessimistic outlook. And in that outlook, the story that creates the pessimistic outlook is trade tensions that reduce demand for U.S. goods because countries on the other side who are trading partners with us retaliate for what they expect to be protectionist trade policies, and reduced business confidence that causes businesses to postpone investment in equipment and structures. So that 25% probability is assigned to that more pessimistic scenario. And in that scenario, there is a two-quarter recession in 2018, so next year. Then they assign the remaining probability, 15%, if I've got my math right, to a more optimistic scenario. And in that scenario, you have more business optimism, and so businesses invest more quickly in equipment and structures, improving worker productivity and creating more economic growth than what's forecast in the baseline.
Yeah. Mr. Doctor, just curious, how do the risk factors differ from the past? Are they similar in nature now or mm-hmm. much accelerated?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if I remember correctly, from the November forecast to the February forecast, the IHS took 5% of probability away from the baseline and put it in the pessimistic scenario. So they lowered the probability of the baseline from 65 to 60, and then they took that and increased the probability of the pessimistic scenario. And then regarding other risk factors, for instance, the assumptions that they make that are important to the forecast, I have a pretty complete listing of risks on pages 12 and 13.
Representative Carlson?
Mr. Chairman,
competition.
I'm just curious, those risk factors, those percentages, are they calculated nationally or would they be Minnesota specific?
Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, representative, members of the committee, those are U.S. So there's no such probability for Minnesota.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson. Thank you. Okay. Seeing no other questions.
Mr. Chair, my name is Margaret Kelly. I'm the State Budget Director, and I'm going to proceed with the expenditure part of our forecast, if that's okay.
Director Kelly, if you could wait just 1 minute. I think Representative Dean might have had a question yet.
I just had one quick one for Dr. Cullen-Bakitis. Looking forward into kind of the next biennium, obviously the longer an economic expansion continues, the more likely you are in any given year of that expansion to have a recession or an end to that. What is the average length, a number of quarters of a recession in Minnesota, and what does the impact of the stimulus have on increasing that or making it more volatile? So how likely, just from outside of the parameters of, you know, the percentages on how worried you are, how long is the average recession and how weird would the next one be based on what we've had with the stimulus and the length of the recession?
Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I do not have averages for the state of Minnesota. What I can say is for a U.S. expansion, the current expansion is well beyond the average length of post-war expansions. It is currently, I believe, the fourth longest on record. It's nearly tied for third longest on record. If it extends until the middle of 2019, it will win. It will be the longest on record. And this forecast, as you saw in the first chart showing real GDP growth, IHS is expecting the U.S. economy to grow beyond that. So they are forecasting that this will be the longest expansion on record. So that is one of the several risks that we are focusing on in this forecast, that when you have a long, slow growth expansion, that you're more vulnerable to external shocks kicking the economy into a recession. Another aspect of this is sort of, you asked about fiscal policy, so we've got sort of a handoff right now between monetary policy and fiscal policy, where the Fed is moving away from their stimulative policy of very low interest rates, and they're gradually rising, increasing interest rates, and they're sort of passing the baton to fiscal stimulus, where the fiscal stimulus might cause the economy to grow faster. They're kind of trying to keep things even. So it's a balancing act between those two actors that has to be done pretty carefully to not tip the economy into recession.
And Mr. Chair and Dr. Cullen-Bakitis, what's the average number of quarters for a recession? If you know, is it a year and a half, something like that?
I do not have that in front of me, but I'm sure I can get it before the meeting's over.
Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. On page 9 of your handout that we have, the book you referred to it, in the, below the bar graphs in italics, you have the higher forecast, okay? And the second half of that, it talks about expected federal stimulus in the form of individual income tax rate cuts and increased infrastructure spending. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad to see that in there. I think that's something that's important. But my other question really has to do with, you mentioned mining earlier in your testimony, and I know that like polymet and twin metals are things that could possibly happen in the future, and they're not reflected in your forecast, I'm guessing, correct?
Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we tend to incorporate into employment forecasts activities when they look very certain to happen, right. So we don't tend to speculate.
Representative,
just a quick follow-up. So then, when that becomes more apparent that it's going to happen, mm-hmm. then how do you calculate that impact into the economy? It seems complicated, and I'm interested in it.
Mm-hmm. Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, so we will, so we look at an industry like mining and we pay close attention to the news about it and what sorts of announcements are being made and what the path is for environmental studies, things like that, and we look to see when it looks like something is going to happen, is highly likely to happen, then we estimate the number of jobs that are going to be added. So we're, our focus from that point in the forecast is how many jobs are going to be added in each sector. And so we try to estimate the number of jobs added, and we're thinking about the capacity of the region to produce iron ore, so what is there excess capacity in other, at other companies? If it's not iron ore, if it's a new type of mining, like copper nickel mining, then we're looking at the capacity to produce that and what we believe the number of jobs will be.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so then to that point, just one step further, and I apologize. You said that you when they become more likely to be included, so for example, the Sandpiper pipeline. At one time, it seemed pretty likely that that was going to happen. Was that reflected in an economic forecast someplace? And then the second part of the question is, if it goes away, then how is it then unreflected in the forecast or the negative reflection?
Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, so we tend not to speculate at all. Like, if a deal is done and people are being called back to work, then we incorporate that into the forecast. If people are laid off, we incorporate that in the forecast and we take those jobs out. So when we add a project, for instance, into the forecast, say it's a big construction project, when you know, everything's signed on the dotted line and we know this thing is going to get built, then we estimate the number of jobs that are going to be added. And if something happens, a company goes bankrupt and the plan ends, then we will take the jobs out.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Fabian's question kind of made me think about another issue, which is health care and the uncertainty that is going to be created by what Congress is now threatening to do to us with health care cuts. And I wonder if there's any, I know you've got, this is a forecast with a lot of uncertainty, and I know you've said that a couple times, but I don't think I've heard anything about the uncertainty created by the expected sharp cuts in funding coming from the federal government into our healthcare sector, which is one of our biggest sectors. So I see on page 9 what Representative Fabian was just referring to. It talks about you're building in expected fiscal stimulus in the form of individual income tax rate cuts and increased infrastructure spending, but I haven't heard anything about the expected $2 billion in cuts from the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, or the expected unknown enormous cut to our Medicaid program apart from or in addition to the Affordable Care Act cut, and that there may be in fact some cuts in the Medicare program, which of course would mean less health care spending in Minnesota. So how is that accounted for in this forecast, where that is, pretty likely to happen, even though we don't really know what the amount is going to be?
Mr. Chairman, so on the point of federal money coming into Minnesota for health care, Budget Director Kelly will cover that, those risks. That's on the, that occurs on the expenditure side. As I said, the IHS has not yet felt there's enough certainty about changes in federal health care policy to incorporate those changes into the economic outlook. And so that is a source of risk to this forecast.
Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, takes a minute sometimes to digest the answers before you have a follow-up. When you referenced that the baseline had been reduced by 5% and the pessimistic increase by 5%, we seem to be moving in the wrong direction from the standpoint of predicting the future. So my question is this, would we be wise to have an additional forecast? And this has been talked about at points in the past, never really moved in that direction, but let's say a midsummer forecast with all of the uncertainty that you're describing? And if we did something like that, how complicated would it be?
Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, members of the committee, it's not clear to me that we're going to have a whole lot more uncertainty by midsummer. So it may or may not be worth anyone's while to reconstruct a forecast then. We might have some more federal policy uncertainty by then. If we were to do that, it would require as much work as what we do for a normal forecast.
Mr. Chairman, you reminded me that when I sat in on the Council of Economic Advisors, they said that we really probably wouldn't know, at least for the first year. Would it be worthwhile to look at the second year of the biennium, let's say a July or August forecast? Would we have more available information at that point as to what the risk factors are and what direction we're going?
Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think you're asking me to forecast how the uncertainty is going to unwind or how the clarification is going to come in. And I simply don't know whether we're going to know more about federal policy this summer than we do now. We may know more about the expected fiscal stimulus, because if we're not closer to a tax bill or to an infrastructure spending bill, then we might think that the probability of those things is lower, the probability of them impacting 2018 is lower.
Mr. Chairman, my second question wasn't then this summer. I understood what you were saying. It was the second year of the biennium. At that point, perhaps we would know more. The reason for my question was your response earlier when I was asking about the optimistic baseline and pessimistic, that we went from 65% baseline to 25% pessimistic, and that's what I meant by we seem to be, with the current forecast, moving in the wrong direction from the standpoint of things getting more pessimistic. And that's why I was asking if it might be valid at some point to have another forecast so that we could respond a little bit faster, perhaps. I remember with your predecessor, well before the forecast coming out, he met with Representative Solberg and myself as the two major fiscal chairs. At the time, I had finance and he had ways and means, giving us a heads up about the what was happening in the housing market and what that would potentially mean. Now, we didn't have hard and fast numbers because it wasn't part of the forecast, but he had picked up some indicators someplace, and we had an informal discussion that we had a real heavy cloud on the horizon, which turned out to be true. Mm-hmm. So, but that's the reason I raised the question, but thank you.
Doctor, one question I do have on the risk factors. I'm wondering how much the Brexit has played into that, as well as the impending French elections, and you know, the threat that if indeed things don't go well in France, that indeed they could look at a Frexit, and the effect that that might have on our rates, and if indeed that's going into part of this assessment as well, because it's as I understand it, it's the Eurozone that's been holding down our rates to some extent more than us ourselves, because they're so low over there and money is so fungible. Comments on that?
Mr. Chairman, at the time of the IHS forecast, so the Brexit was, of course, known about, and the impacts were known about. So that is all of that risk is baked in here. And what IHS has forecast for global growth is slow global growth. And so that's part of an optimistic forecast would be higher global growth than what they expect. So they expect slow global growth. But if things get worse than that will impact the United States and will impact demand for our goods. And what's also embedded here is the Fed doing a lot, moving slowly away from accommodative monetary policy and increasing interest rates, and if the Fed feels the need to either accelerate that or to slow the economy down or reverse it in order to boost the economy, then we'll have a different outcome than what had been anticipated. Let me just add, I have the answer to the question about the average length of expansions. The average length of economic expansions on record in the U.S. is, of all, going back to the 1850s, it's 38.7 months is the average length of an expansion. Going back post-World War II, expansions have been longer since the World War II, and that's 58.4 months. And we're currently at about 91, 92. Is that right?
Thank you. Representative Davis, I believe, has a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Dr. Kolomakidis, maybe to Ms. Kelly, how do you forecast, how do you calculate with the ACA, the extremely high premiums, the tremendous increases, 102% increases in the last 2 years, the record high deductibles that people have, bankrupting Minnesotans. How is that figured in right now? And in the governor's State of the State address, he said half the bankruptcies are with people that have health insurance. So how do you calculate the disastrous effects of the ACA as a drag on the economy? Or maybe that's a question for Ms. Kelly.
To you or the testifiers, I guess.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we simply forecast in the expenditure side of the story state spending for health care, and we don't make projections about individual health care costs.
So, Mr. Chairman, then as people are going bankrupt because of the disastrous effects of the ACA, that doesn't really show up. It'd just be less income coming because they have less money to spend and they're bankrupt because of the ACA.
Director?
Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, the current situation regarding the health care system in the state of Minnesota and everybody's premiums and everybody's income, those are all baked in the cake here. So the current forecast knows what the situation is in Minnesota.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Kolomakidis, you have another way to calculate what a drag those extremely high premiums are and the bankruptcies are on your budget forecast?
Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, I do not on the revenue side.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Director Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to speak to the spending side of the equation here. The slide that is up on the screen can also be found on pages 40 and 42 of the document that you have. Healthcare spending increases in the next biennium, overall. If you look at the bottom line of this table, you'll see that there's a very small change in spending with this forecast for the current biennium and the next biennium compared to our previous estimates. Only a $12 million reduction in spending in the 16-17 biennium, $156 million increase in spending in the next biennium. In all 4 years of our forecast, the growth in education spending increases, $24 million with this biennium, you can see on the top line there, and $95 million the next biennium. We have better, more accurate data on student counts, which are higher than we had projected previously. In addition, special education costs have grown overall this past year, which increases our estimates for the forecast period. Both of these increases in our estimates are offset somewhat by lower poverty concentration estimates, which then lower the cost of some of our education formulas. And that's a trend that we have seen in several forecasts now. The Health and Human Services spending line has been lowered in the current biennium by $42 million and increased in the next biennium by $73 million. In the current biennium, we continue to see the average cost of care for home and community-based services and certain waivered services decline with growing enrollment in those programs. This is a trend we saw in November, and we continue to see with this forecast. In addition, enrollment has been lowered in the basic health care programs for this fiscal year and the next few years as well. That is the reason for the lower spending in the 16-17 biennium. However, health care spending will increase in the next biennium by $73 million as the cost of care grows. There are several reasons for the growing cost of care. One is the exit of Medica from the state health care contract. 300,000 families with children and adults without children will need to move to other plans in the public in our contract, which will increase average payments and drive up our costs. This is in addition to an overall increase in the average cost of care based on trends we're seeing in actual costs in fiscal year 16. Finally, the savings we had anticipated from more frequent enrollment verification called periodic data matching are being delayed in this forecast due to implementation challenges. Next, we'll take a look at the bottom line for the budget outlook for all of the biennium we're forecasting. This slide here shows 16-17, which is on page 28 of your document. The current biennium has only 5 months left to go, and so we continue to project a surplus in the current biennium, increasing to $743 million with this forecast. That's $75 million of additional revenues and $12 million of lower spending, netting to an $87 million change. For the next biennium, you'll find that on page 29 of your document. This is our next budget period, the period where you'll be putting a budget together this legislative session. The balance here has improved as well by $250 million. $321 million of additional revenues are offset by $156 million of additional spending, creating a net increase of $250 million of balance. And then finally, looking at the 2021 biennium, which is on page 31 of your document, our planning estimates have improved as well with this forecast. The trends from 18 and 19 continue into 20 and 21, with a more sizable bump in revenue that will increase our average annual revenue growth to 4% over the four-year period. Spending growth continues at a slower pace of only 2.7%. Structural balance improves with this forecast in both biennia, but inflationary pressures will increase with this forecast, with CPI estimates as high as 2.7% compared to 2.6% with the last forecast. Mr. Chair, that brings us to the end of our forecast presentation, and we continue to see positive signs across the state in terms of Minnesota being ranked one of the number three best-managed states, best-run states, the best state for job creation, and last summer having improved one of our ratings from a AA-plus to a AAA rating. If there aren't any more questions, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Kolumbakidis to talk about the variance report.
Representative Dean, I believe, has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Budget Director Kelly. I just have a question about the $46 million for the periodic data match and the delay in increase. This delay increases forecast spending by $46 million in 2018-19. Could you just say what is that $46 million, what is that being spent on?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, the savings that were anticipated were in the Medicaid program.
Representative Dean?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Kelly. So that's not $46 million to do what we asked them to do before. That's $46 million of spending on people that we think aren't qualified for the programs. Is that correct?
Director?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, the $46 million of savings was, I believe, identified in a fiscal note at the end of session with the periodic data matching, that the more frequently you verify enrollment, the more churn you have in enrollment and people leaving the program. And so the savings that were identified are being pushed out into the next biennium.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Kelly. So that, just so folks know, that's not $46 million that we're going to spend trying to make sure that people are qualified for the right program. That's $46 million that we're currently spending on people that don't qualify for programs. And we did ask them to do this. We directed the administration to do this, and so far they have not started, and that's the result.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wonder if Budget Director Kelly or maybe if somebody else could remind us, I think that Representative Dean's point is well taken in that, you know, explaining what this is. It's good to understand what that is. But as I've understood it, there were some real structural reasons why the periodic data match hasn't been able to be accomplished, and they're not for lack of wanting to. And I wonder if you or somebody could explain briefly why that hasn't been able to happen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, my understanding is there's two reasons for the delay. One is that changes to the computer systems that verify eligibility need to be made and are taking longer than anticipated. Second reason is there are data privacy issues around the Department of Human Services accessing people's income tax records, and those data issues, data privacy issues, have not yet been resolved with the federal IRS.
Okay, and then
Representative.
So, and then Mr. Chair and Budget Director Kelly, you know, also the it is a rather large number. This, I guess, $46 million that is there because we are haven't gotten this data match going. But you know, if is it expected that, or is the meaning of that number that there are $46 million being just somehow sort of stolen from Minnesota, or is it that some of those people might be in the wrong program, or, can you give us a little more understanding of what the meaning is of that pretty large number? And, you know, the other piece of that, too, I just want to say before you answer that question is that, you know, as much as we don't want to spend money on people who are not eligible, that's money that is being spent at Minnesota for Minnesota hospitals and other providers. So in the sense that, it's not as though somebody's, I assume, stealing money from the state, because it is money that's being spent on behalf of people. But can you explain, is it that, we need to really, really hurry up because this, we don't want to spend $46 million that we shouldn't be spending, that's for sure. Nobody wants to do that. Is that kind of really the meaning of that number?
Director.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I think you would need to speak to the Department of Human Services to get the specifics of the periodic data matching. My understanding may not be deep enough to answer your question. My understanding is, though, that current enrollment is verified on an annual basis. And during a period of 12 months, people who are at this income level may have changes in their income, either increasing their income or lowering their income, several times during a 12-month period. And if you verify their income eligibility more frequently than every 12 months, you may hit on a period of time when their income is higher than the amount allowed with the Medicaid program. And so it could be that within a period of a month their income is back down below. It could be that their income rises and they stay, their income is higher throughout the 12-month period. And if their income falls below, with periodic data matching, they would need to reapply then to get back on the program. So the extent to which $46 million is being spent on individuals that are no longer eligible would need further study. Some of them may become eligible again during that 12-month period, because at this income level, people's incomes varies from month to month.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is a question for you or for maybe Representative Carlson, only because you haven't been on the committee very long, and this is my first tenure, my first round on Ways and Means. But when I hear this question about the periodic data matching issue, it reminds me of the times over my tenure where we have been cautioned by or warned by the administration about our ambition to implement an idea and where our ambition might not match with reality. And so sometimes we get to this place where we have put something into a budget when we have been warned that it can't be implemented in the time frame or in the way that we want it to be. But we don't always listen to that as legislators. And so my question really for you, Mr. Chair, for Representative Carlson, is if the Ways and Means Committee is one of the places where we vet that out in the budgets as they come through to us. So here we are, you know, coming into the part of the legislature where we're going to really in earnest set the state's budget. And I am sure in the various budget bills there may be new ideas or things that we're going to want to ask the administration to do. And it seems to me that this committee would be one of the last stops before we go to the floor to really test that out, to really hear from the administration about whether or not there are weaknesses in that the place for us to debate before we take something to the floor about the value of or the possibility of actually moving forward with an idea if we're being told it doesn't work. Is that is this committee the place where that happens, Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Representative. I believe it could be today. Obviously, it wouldn't be the format for that because we still have a few things to get through, but certainly talk to Chair Knobloch about that and see if indeed that might make sense to do.
And Mr. Chair, would it be okay if I asked Representative Carlson that, because he's served on this committee for such a long time, and maybe he can offer a little guidance as well?
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, only since its creation. Seriously. Okay, about in the mid-80s.
Creation?
Yeah, we didn't have a Ways and Means Committee until about the mid-80s. It was all done in what we called the Appropriations Committee at the time, which had four funding divisions. But I think in answer to your question, you know, the bills are always being reviewed, and sometimes when you're dealing with a new program or a state agency, it's done both informally and formally, so that they kind of give you a heads up in terms of what realistic expectations might be. I can remember at least one occasion where we held up one of the major funding bills because we needed more information, and part of it was dealing with a new program and getting some better fiscal analysis of what that program would be, and then we took care of it here in Ways and Means. More often it's done in the funding committees before it ever comes to Ways and Means if there's a problem that surfaces, and I'm talking now more about the timing, you know, what they can do as a practical matter.
Okay. Well, thank you, and I'll keep that in mind and see where we could go with it.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Doctor, I think you're going to do the revenue forecast uncertainty report.
Yes,
and
thank you.
This is in your second green sleeve. It's behind the price of government if somebody wants to pull out the pieces of paper.
Oh, yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so the committee has the report? Okay, great. I just want to give you a little bit of background here about the forecast uncertainty report. And that is that, as you know, actual revenues never precisely match a forecast. And for a lot of reasons, we've talked about the U.S. economy may be imperfectly forecast, of course. When we translate the U.S. economy forecast into the Minnesota economy forecast, then we don't necessarily get all of that exactly the way it's going to be. And even if we had the economy perfectly forecast, we wouldn't forecast tax revenues exactly right because we don't have perfect modeling given economic data like wages and interest and capital gains, for instance. And the data that we use, even the historic data that we use, get changed. They get revised. And so those changes and revisions get fed into our forecast. So those are a lot of the reasons why when we get to the end of the biennium, the number is going to be, the revenue number is going to be different than what we had forecast. Another point about this is that there's no single uncertainty rate or error rate for a forecast because we forecast a biennium several times. because we do, you know, we do it before the first, we do it, you know, for instance, for the 18-19 biennium, we forecast it last November, and then we just forecast it again this February, and this is the point where you develop a budget for it. But then we keep reforecasting it, reconstructing that forecast until it's done. And so that kind of gets a bit to Representative Carlson's question about uncertainty, and that we will reforecast the next biennium, 18-19, in November. And so any new economic information that comes in between now and November will feed into that. So if you think about the difference between the number we forecast and the number that actually, the closing number for a biennium, think of that as an error rate, so how far off we were. What this report tells you is, on average, how far off are we? And that number changes depending on how far out the forecast is. So the closer we get to the end of a biennium, the smaller that error rate, because we have more information and because a lot of the revenues have already been collected. The average error rate is the difference between the forecast and the closing number. And if we look at those average, look at those errors just on absolute values, so we treat positive and negative errors the same and then create an average across our own history of forecasting, that's what's called the mean absolute error, the average error. And that's the first thing that I report in the report. This report was completed for the November 16 forecast. It's due 2 weeks after each forecast, and so we do not have the numbers updated for the February forecast. But what we were reporting for at the time of the November forecast was that for the current biennium, 16-17, the average error rate was 1.3%. So that would mean that that biennium would end, if we had the same level of accuracy as we have in the past, then you would expect the current biennium to end either up or down by 1.3%. For next biennium, 18-19, this was a forecast that's 32 months ahead of the closing of that biennium. Our average error rate for 32 months ahead forecasts was 6.5%. So at the time of the November forecast, if you wanted to place a bet on how that biennium would end, the range you would be looking at is plus or minus 6.5%. And that's if our level of accuracy is the same as it has been in the past. There are additional ways you can look at this. Sometimes people want to talk about a confidence interval or a 90% confidence interval. That average error rate that I just talked about is about a 60% confidence interval. So that means that if you did the forecast 100 times, you would expect to be the final number to be within that range 60% of the time. A 90% confidence interval is also reported in the report. It's a larger number. So, because it's a larger degree of confidence. And so for the 16-17 biennium at the time of the November forecast, that 90% confidence interval was plus or minus 2% of net general fund revenues. And for the 18-19 biennium, it was as large as plus or minus 12.5%. So I can't give you specific numbers for the current forecast for the 18-19 biennium, but roughly I think that the average error rate for forecasts at that period, so 29 months ahead, was plus or minus 5.4%. So you can apply that number to the revenue number for the 17 forecast to get an approximate range of where we think we will end up. The bottom line is that given the history and given the kinds of ways that a forecast can be off, you should expect a pretty large range for a forecast that's being done 29 months ahead of the closing of the fiscal year. Another thing I would add is that in calculating our average error rates, the ranges do seem large, but they're actually better than what the Congressional Budget Office calculates for their own error rates. And so our accuracy is as good as that. I'm happy to take any questions.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Doctor, so based on that, if we were to look over the last 6 years and what our average potential error rate is, what is the potential of the $1.6 billion on the negative? What would, if we were to take the negative side of that average, what could it potentially be instead?
Doctor?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I haven't calculated strictly negative errors. So what we did was we treated positive and negative errors the same and came up with the average, absolute value average. But if you're talking about the 18-19 biennium, as of the November 16 forecast, average accuracy for a forecast that was at that time was 32 months ahead for fiscal year 18-19, it would be a range of plus or minus $2.914 billion. So on the negative side, you would expect you could be as far off as $2.9 billion. So that was, at the time, that was a range of $42.4 to $48.2 billion.
Representative Anderson?
Mr. Chair and Doctor, would it be possible for us to kind of get a spreadsheet that could show that potential? And basing it off, in particular, I'm looking at if we were to compare over the last 6 years, kind of that error rate, or the plus or minus rate, I should say. And not right now, obviously, but, yeah, later, if
Dr. Quinn.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the error rate that we've calculated is over more than 6 years. It's over, I can't remember the number of years. I probably have it on my chart. I do not. Oh, it's the sample period for our error rate was the 90-91 biennium to the 14-15 biennium. So that the error rates that I've talked about are over that period.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Doctor, is it possible, though, to get a smaller range, say just the last 10 years versus, and that's a significant, I'm guessing that changes the dynamic based upon the number of years that you're looking at.
Doctor?
So I'm looking at a window of, you know, 2017 to maybe 2007.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the way these error rates are calculated, it's you calculate an error rate for a biennium. So you're saying from like the 6-7 biennium to the 14-15 is the last, 16-17 would be the last we have. I guess we could calculate that. But it would be, again, different error rates for forecasts for different distances from the closing. So there's no single number that you're talking about. And I'm not sure I'm following why you want it over a shorter period. So I would simply ask that.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think it would be more in line with what we've seen in our economy, kind of measuring the volatility, if you will, in recent history versus tying in years going back to, I think you said it was 1990, 91. I mean, there's been a lot that's changed within our history, and I'd be more interested in looking at that chunk of time versus going all the way back to the early 90s. Especially when you consider 2007, 2008, that would have included the major crash in the housing market and all that good stuff, too. I think it would just be a better indicator for what I'm looking to see here. So.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think I understand that. It would be an average over a much smaller number of data points, and so statistically it's not as reliable, but I understand your why you want to look at it.
Representative Nornis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question. I just wanted to say thank you for being here, and I also am very thankful that you are here. and understand this, because I don't. And so it's helpful to know people are really on top of this, and then we can rely on those numbers so that then we can proceed with our individual committees and assignments to get our work done. So it's very important, and again, I just wanted to say thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, I'll second that, and as one who has a chance to watch Dr. Kalambakidis with the Council of Economic Advisors, she does an excellent job there with that group as well. But I did have a question, and how does time figure into when we're dealing with the potential for error? Are we comparing the beginning of the biennium with the end? Mm-hmm. And we've had situations where there's been a major economic shift once we're well into the biennium. Mm-hmm. And then the ability to correct things is much greater. I don't know why I got a frog in my throat here, but I do. So how does time figure into the calculation of those errors?
Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, members of the committee. So the further we are out from the end of a biennium, the more risky that forecast is and the wider that error is. So it gets more accurate the closer we get to it, because if there's something disruptive that's going to happen over that time period, it will have happened by the time you get close to the end of the biennium, and you will have collected more of the revenue, so you know more of it is in the bank. So it matters a lot, and it can, you know, things can change. We've seen, you know, the economic forecast change from the November forecast to the February forecast changed quite a bit, and it's highly likely to change quite a bit from February to November. But when we are, which is why on my list of risks for this forecast, I mentioned the fact that for 18-19, we're forecasting out 28, 29 months. And so for our error rates, that's a very high confidence interval that you're talking, a very wide confidence interval that we're talking about. And there's nothing we can do, there's little that we can do to, we can't model out all of the risk to the forecast. And it would be, I wouldn't want to leave you with the impression that we could. So it is imperative when using a point estimate forecast like what we provide to pay attention to all of the things that could happen between now and the time that biennium closes, and ensure against that risk, because we can't eliminate it.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for the presentations. I think it's on to price of government.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Brian Dahl to join me at the table here. Brian is our Director of Financial Planning, and he oversees the work of pulling together our price of government report and our expenditure forecast and the budget forecast as well, amongst other things, the consolidated fund statement. So I'm just going to give you an overview and let Mr. Dahl go into the detail, but we are going to talk today about the price of government that we use as a measurement to describe the relative cost of state and local governments. It's defined as total state and local revenues combined divided by total Minnesota personal income. And you get a ratio or a percentage from that. And it reflects how much each dollar earned goes to support state and local governments together. So it provides a lot of transparency. Our report itself does, in that we can show the numbers in a variety of ways. We can compare our revenue raise as a percent of personal income. We also break out our revenue mix by the type, so you can see whether it's income sales, property, or other taxes, as well as fees and other non-tax revenue sources that are collected. And you can see how much of it comes from state government versus collected at the state level versus the local level. And we prepare this with each forecast, and it's a statutory requirement as well. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Dahl here.
Welcome, Mr. Dahl. If you could identify yourself for the record and then proceed, please.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Brian Dahl, Financial Mining Director with Minnesota Management and Budget. Turning to slide number 3, I'm going to talk about the individual components of the price of government. First, state and local revenues. The price of government identifies revenues by various sources. Own source revenues, those are revenues collected directly by the state, local units of government, or school district.
Mr. Dolph, I could just interrupt. I don't think we have the slides, right? We'll have to just watch on the screen.
Yeah, it's on the screen. Yep. It generally follows along with the report that I think that you all have. But
thank you.
A slightly different order, possibly. So I was at own source revenues.
Mr. Chair?
No.
Yes.
Are we going to be able to get copies of these slides, the last presentation and this presentation, so we can cross-reference with our booklets?
I am seeing the head shake, so yes, we will. Thank you.
So we are on page 2 of the handout talking about the revenue sources. Again, own source revenues, those are revenues collected directly by the state, local units of government, or school districts. And these include taxes, all state taxes, local property taxes, and local option taxes. And then non-tax revenue, so licenses and permits, charges for services or fees, investment earnings, special assessments, and tuition. And then we also include intergovernmental revenues. So this identifies state aids, local aids, and federal grant revenue. Generally, we'd think of this as payments between units of government or the state and the federal government. And then the price of government does exclude some revenue sources. And these are generally enterprise revenues like liquor store revenues or pension revenues. And then one further point, the price of government does not include federal tax revenue in the report. So moving on to the next slide. To compute the price of government, we compare revenues described on the previous slide to Minnesota personal income. Minnesota personal income is a broad measure of Minnesota's total economic activity. It includes the dollar value of personal receipts from wage and salary income, proprietor income, interest dividends and rent income, and transfer payments, including unemployment compensation, Social Security, and Medicare. Personal income is estimated by the Bureau of Economic Analysis and is projected with each November and February forecast by MMD economists using state and national econometric models.
Mr. Powell, I think Representative Anderson has a question. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dahl, you said that some special revenues are excluded. Can you give me some examples of which ones, or is it all special revenue funds within state government that are excluded?
Representative. Most special revenue funds are included in the price of government. For state government, we would exclude pension revenues, enterprise revenues, things like payments between state agencies, payments from one agency to, say, Minute to pay for Minute services. As those revenues are already collected once, we wouldn't want to double count them in the formula.
Chair Anderson, to yield to our committee. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dahl, so, for example, the state auditor currently has an enterprise fund. Would that be counted as part of this?
Mr. Dahl.
I have to think about that. Director Kelly, do you have thoughts on there? I'm not so familiar with the state auditor's budget and how it works, so I don't know if I can answer that question right now.
Mr.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Dahl, can you get back to me on
Absolutely.
That? Thank you.
Please proceed.
Thanks. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think we are on slide 5. And that's looking at the price of government for this current fiscal year, FY17. And this, I should note, is as of the November forecast. We are working diligently this week to complete the price of government for the February forecast. The price of government projects that 15.4 cents of each dollar of economic activity will be paid for state and local services in the current fiscal year. Total state and local own source revenue will reach about $45 billion, and this excludes federal, state, and local aid payments. Total total personal income is projected to be about $291 billion in fiscal year 2017. Of the $45 billion, the state will collect approximately 63%, or $28 billion. Cities, counties, towns, and special districts will collect 29%, or $13 billion, and school districts will collect 8%, or $3 billion. Turning to the next slide, one of the things the price of government does for us is highlight the state's role of collecting a majority of revenues, but ultimately spending approximately only a third of those revenues. In 2017, it's projected that the state will collect $28 billion out of the total $45 billion, but then the state passes on almost half of those resources to school districts and other local governments, ultimately spending 37%, or about $17 billion of that total. Moving on to the next slide.
Mr. Ball, question. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dahl, on those slides, the who collects and who spends, I'd be curious to know what are the administrative costs of the state collecting all that revenue and then sending that back out to schools, local governments, and so forth.
Mr. Dahl.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know that I can give a specific answer to that question right now, but certainly state agencies, Department of Education is one that comes to mind, has administrative staff processing these payments. I think we could provide some specificity.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I would just add that some of the taxes are best collected at the state level. So, for example, we're collecting income tax and sales tax, and we're redistributing that in the form of local government aids and in the form of school payments. And so those are taxes that, while it may cost the state to collect them on behalf of the local unit of government, it would not make sense for the local unit of government to be collecting them. At the local level, what is collected is primarily property tax revenue, which makes sense to be collected at the local level, although we do have a statewide property tax that is collected by the Department of Revenue.
Representative Kevin? I'm sorry, was it Representative Fabian?
Well, just a point there. There's lots of other local option sales taxes. The Metropolitan Council collects a tremendous amount of revenue. So I'm just curious to know what it costs to do that.
Mr. Bell, I think you can proceed.
Sure. Moving on to slide number 7. This slide shows historic and projected price of government as of the November 2016 forecast. The price of government has been produced since 1991. From 1991 through 1998, the price of government hovered around 17 to 18% in each year, with its all-time peak in 1994 at 17.9%. From 1999 forward, the price of government has floated in the 15 to 16% range each year, with an all-time low in 2009 of 14.7%. The most recent closed fiscal year, 2016, price of government was 15.7%, up slightly from FY15's 15.6%. This slide is showing historical price of government and revenue and personal income over time since 2003. It's important to note that the price of government is sensitive to changes in revenues and personal income. If both revenue and personal income change at a similar rate and in the same direction, generally the price of government will not change significantly. However, when changes in policy or the economy cause revenue and personal income to change in opposite ways, the change in the price of government calculation can be more dramatic. I've highlighted 2 years in the past to show this. First, in FY2010, state and local revenue was roughly flat compared to the prior year, growing at only 0.8%. But personal income actually decreased 5.2% compared to the prior year. This caused the price of government calculation to increase almost a full percentage point compared to the prior year. In fiscal year 2013, the opposite occurred. State and local revenue actually fell year over year, while personal income continued to grow. This caused the price of government calculation to swing in the opposite direction, falling from 16.3% to 15.3%. Then turning to my final slide, finally some detail on the price of government forecast. We currently project price of government to fall each year from FY 2017 to FY 2021. Obviously, as we move further into the forecast horizon, the higher the risk of error on both revenue and personal income sides of the equation. But under the current forecast, price of government is projected to fall to approximately 14.5% in fiscal year 2021. Income tax as a percentage of personal income is projected to increase, but otherwise all other revenue sources are projected to decline as a percentage of personal income over that time period. There could be several reasons for this, including the possibility that personal income will grow faster than state and local revenue. But this projection is also reliant on underlying assumptions of all individual revenue forecasts included in the price of government. The revenue projections are based on current law and don't assume policy actions that could, for instance, increase a fee or a tuition revenue source. But this is our best projection using the available data we have today. And with that, I can take questions if there are any.
Are there any questions? Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dole, there's lots of mandates that the government passes on to local entities, I'll say. So when the state takes action that's going to result in, say, higher insurance premiums or increased utility rates, those would be assessed in the private market, per se, but would those costs be reflected in the price of government?
Mr. Dole.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the price of government includes revenue sources collected directly by the state and local governments. So to the extent those policy changes impact actual revenue collections, they could be included in the price of government projections. The revenue forecast here is similar to what Dr. Kolumbakidis just explained to us. So to the extent there are changes in policy, those revenue changes would be picked up here as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But to the extent that, say, mandates on renewable energy have increased electric rates in my part of the state by 100% in the last 8 to 10 years, those dollars come out of consumers' pockets and go to our local municipal utilities or our rural electric co-ops. That's something that government did. Is that reflected in the price of government?
Mr. Dahl.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I want to confirm, you know, I better get back to you on that question. I don't want to speak definitively without knowing a full answer.
Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, now it's been 25 years, and my question is, I think we were at the forefront of trying to use this as a benchmark back in 1991. Are there any other states that have this kind of a system to determine the price of government that you're aware of? And if there are the definitions similar? So if we were to compare the price of government, let's say, with our neighboring state of Wisconsin, if they do this kind of thing, would we have something that would be comparable?
Mr. Dahl.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not aware of what other states do for this report, but I think we could look around a little bit and get back to you on that.
Mr. Chair, that might be something that NCSL could perhaps provide us with, but I'm curious, being that we were at the forefront. Mr. Chairman, my other question is, you know, 25 years ago, there was a group, I think, that met that tried to determine what was in the price of government and what was not. And I think at one time we had a list that had been distributed in this committee or some other committee that showed what was in and what was out. With a couple of the earlier questions, maybe that would be somewhat helpful for members if such a list still exists. and maybe Mr. Markson was whether one exists or yet or not. I don't know. He was smiling. He may have been involved in 1991. I don't know.
He's smiling, but he's not pulling down his mic. I would assume we could check into that.
But if that information is available, what's in and out, it might be helpful.
Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I did want to point out that on the last two pages of the report in your folders, we do include the revenues that are included in the price of government. They're itemized. They're at a relatively high level, but they're broken out by state revenue sources, school district revenue sources, and local government revenue sources.
And, Mr. Chair, the list that I'm recalling is more detailed than what we have here.
Good. Well, seeing no other questions, we will be meeting Wednesday. On your agenda, it says 7 o'clock, but that's a misprint. It's going to be 7:30 p.m. in 120 in the Capitol. So the meeting will be Wednesday at 7:30, not 7 o'clock as published. And with that, we're adjourned.